Thought I would be good, and rather than generating a handout that I have to print out and all this sort of stuff, I'd make some slides so you'd have something to look at. And the projector's gone. So we're just going to have to make do. You have to look at my pretty face as I work through the slides. Maybe I can do my best to describe them. But then I need to see them too. So obviously we'll press on. As far as just before we get started, the trip to the Adams Museum, I have picked the date that I think will work the best, and I know it's not going to work for everyone, but it's Sunday, September 7th. If you're able to make it, please come see me after class today. I'd like to get a finalized list together to finalize and make the reservation. So again, if you're able to come out September 7th, I'm thinking we'll leave pretty much right after church. Should give us plenty of time to get down there, maybe grab a bite to eat, and do a tour sometime around 3, maybe 3:30. The tour itself is, I think, about 2 hours. So we'd be wrapping up 5:30, get back here 7, 8 o'clock, somewhere around there. So if you're available and still interested, September 7th is the date that we're going to go with. As we begin this morning, I sort of realized as I was looking at my schedule that I have essentially completely ignored the last few weeks, that I really only have this week and next week to continue speaking about Adams and Jefferson. So with that in mind, rather than spending a lot of time discussing the presidencies of both Adams and Jefferson moving forward, I'm going to have to sort of skip over and choose what I cover, and as a result, the main theme of this course is the relationship between Adams and Jefferson, and so as a result, I'm going to sort of just hit highlights of the history and not so much delve into a lot of the detail there, and as a result, I'll essentially, for all intents and purposes, skip over almost entirely Jefferson's presidency, which hopefully you'll see the justification for why as we go through today. So that brings us to today's business, which is tracking the relationship as the friendship breaks down and essentially is broken. During the 1790s and into 1800. So as the title slide says, we'll get into a little bit of the why and the how and some of the implications. To do that, we need to sort of pick up a little bit where we left off, and that is both Adams and Jefferson serving in Europe as ministers for the new republic. Of course, Jefferson in France, where he succeeds but does not replace Benjamin Franklin, and Adams is selected as the first minister or ambassador to Great Britain, which the HBO miniseries John Adams, which we took a look at last week, did I thought a marvelous job of sort of encapsulating this time frame where the relationship between the Adams family and the Jefferson family was really solidified and strengthened, and it also did a good job of highlighting some of the differences between Adams and Jefferson in some subtle ways. One of my favorite parts is right there at the last scene we took a look at, where there's the hot air balloon. They're in the city square, and Adams is of the opinion that there's no way possible this thing is going to be able to get off the ground unless it's being pulled by ropes. And Jefferson, of course, a little bit more idealistic, is open to the possibility of that being a reality. And sure enough, it does lift off. And Adams sort of has the last word after Jefferson says, now we're no longer bound to the earth. And Adams says, yeah, but we're being supported by a bunch of hot air, which is just kind of a nice way of summing up Adams' view on things sometimes. So with that, over the several years that they're in Europe working as diplomats together, they have plenty of correspondence, both Adams and Jefferson is on official business, but also Abigail and Jefferson also have correspondence, which is quite interesting. At the end of the, Jefferson has a little bit more success dealing with the French, who, as a result of coming through, with the French-American alliance, he's able to work through and negotiate some trade alliance and trade agreements with the French court. However, John Adams is basically met with, a nice way to put it would be indifference in the British court. There's not a lot of confidence in the new American nation, but there's also, obviously, in Great Britain, there's a sense of prejudice, and he has a difficult time and isn't able to accomplish much. But there is an interesting period of time where Jefferson joins Adams for a time in London. They actually do a short tour of some English cities and different things where they're traveling together. They're not on any official business. And it's after his return to Paris that Jefferson writes this, which is just kind of an interesting, I think, look into how Jefferson viewed his relationship with Adams, in the sense that he did recognize Adams had faults in different things, but came to actually really, really like him as a person and as a good friend. He writes this to Madison shortly after his return to Paris. "You know the opinion I formerly entertained of my friend Mr. Adams. Yourself and the governor were the first who shook that opinion. I afterwards saw proofs which convicted him of a degree of vanity and of blindness to it, of which no germ had appeared in Congress. A 7 months' intimacy with him here, and as many weeks in London, have given me opportunities of studying him closely. He is vain, irritable, and a bad calculator of the force and probable effect of the motives which govern men. This is all the ill which can be said of him. He is as disinterested as the being which made him. He is profound in his views and accurate in his judgment, except where knowledge of the world is necessary to form a judgment. He is so amiable that I pronounce you will love him if ever you become acquainted with him." So it's certainly not all glowing, but it's, you can kind of see it's almost as if he's admitting that against my better judgment, I love this guy. So it's just kind of an interesting letter. So with that, Adams returns home thinking that really his political career is over in 1788. Jefferson remains in Paris until just prior to really the outset of the French Revolution in 1789. And so, they both return home to what becomes essentially a new national government, and that is from 1781, I believe they were ratified. The Articles of Confederation was the governing document of the new nation up until the Constitution was ratified. So there were, and not to get into a lengthy debate, which I'm sure we could, in terms of whether the Articles were sufficient or whether the Constitution was necessary. Suffice it to say, there were difficulties under the Articles. One of the major ones was dealing with the individual state debts that had accumulated during the war, and foreign policy was consequently made more difficult because there wasn't a strong unifying voice speaking for the American public. The Congress was very, oftentimes had difficulty actually achieving a quorum in order to vote on different foreign policy things, which delayed things even more than they were in those days. Those certainly fed into some of the frustrations and difficulties that Adams and Jefferson, as well as other ministers to Europe and around the world, ran into. So there was a push beginning mid-1780s, led predominantly by Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, in pushing for a stronger national government. And it's interesting that these two gentlemen actually sort of work hand in hand now, because they actually become later political enemies and sort of divide down the road. But in at this point, they work together and push towards they're really in favor of a wholesale change in the Articles. Most people are for tweaking the Articles, and there's a very small portion, but substantial portion that think the Articles are fine. And this is where Madison coins this term federalism, the idea of shared sovereignty between the federal government and the state governments. And so working together with Hamilton and through various publications and papers, they worked together to get a constitutional convention called. And quite smartly, it's called as a convention to sort of gather and discuss potential changes to the Articles of Confederation. And of course, in the back of their mind, what they want to do is get rid of the Articles and create a new government. And ultimately, that's obviously what happens. And I just work through that and mention it because, as you said, Mr. Marshall, it's a really good example in history of, those who show up decide what the government is going to be. Because the small but substantial faction that really didn't want to see any changes in the Articles just completely boycotted the convention, so had absolutely no say in what ultimately became the new national government. So as Adams and Jefferson return, it's not too long before the convention. Obviously, Jefferson is still in France at the time, but they do return in time to become key members of the first administration, in fitting with their revolutionary credentials, if you will. They're both given key positions. John Adams, of course, is elected as the first vice president. And Thomas Jefferson is called upon by Washington to become his Secretary of State. So John Adams is probably not a worse position for someone of John Adams' character than what becomes of the vice presidency, because it's a position of high office, but you're not really called on to do much, and that that's something that John Adams certainly struggled with quite a bit. And he describes the office as splendid misery. In a letter to Abigail, he says, "My country has in its wisdom contrived for me the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived." And in fact, part of his duties as vice president is to be essentially the president of the Senate, sit on the Senate. He's not a voting member, except in situations where there's a tie. But he gets himself in a lot of trouble because he finds it difficult to sit there without speaking. And so, of course, political enemies use that against him, and it works to his disadvantage, unfortunately. Thomas Jefferson, again, Secretary of State, and what begins to happen is even within Washington's cabinet, there's already a fracture beginning to develop along what become party lines. Jefferson opposes Alexander Hamilton, his financial plans that he has for the country, and it gets to a point where he actually resigns the office in December of 1793, which is just after Washington gets elected to his second term in 1792. So, and that resignation, that feud with Hamilton, that disagreement with Hamilton, really underlines what the issues were that were going on during the 1790s, and that was formation of an opposition party. There wasn't agreement, to say the least, on exactly what American independence was supposed to mean. And so, even after the Constitution is ratified, people essentially fall into one of two camps. On one hand, you have the Federalists, which are ultimately, they're led by Hamilton. They're sort of considered the spirit of 1787. Their emphasis is on a strong national government, that the American independence really was brought to fruition when that national government was created, and they tend to favor, for the long-term interests of the country, tend to favor Great Britain and having peaceful and positive economic relations with Great Britain. Whereas the Republicans sort of are just what you'd think in an opposition party, just the opposite. They're led by Jefferson to a large degree, but also Madison is heavily involved, particularly in helping Jefferson. And they're sort of the spirit of 1776 in the sense that they feel like the American independence was this was embodied in the Declaration and this idea of kind of throwing off tyranny, and they feel like that the Federalists are coming in and corrupting that that idea, that spirit. So they have an emphasis on state sovereignty. They tend to support France and even the French Revolution until it really deteriorates and becomes extremely bloody. So those are sort of what ends up happening, and it really builds throughout the 1790s. As I mentioned, Jefferson resigns in 1793. The party itself, it's sort of hard to pinpoint a date, but 1791, 1792 is where it really begins to take form. And what's interesting is that neither party wanted to be considered a party. To be considered a party was, or part of a party, a member of a party, was actually not a positive thing. And you know, it's if you were a party man, you had given up virtue for the sake of or given up principle for the sake of personal gain. Jefferson himself put it this way: if I could not go to heaven but with a party, I would not go there at all. Sort of an interesting statement from Jefferson, given all that he actually did to create the Republican Party and create that opposition. But he didn't consider himself a part of a party. That much is for sure. So what this became was both parties, for lack of a better term, hire newspaper editors to basically have generate public smear campaigns against the opposition candidates. And it's obviously it's designed to shape public opinion, and the truth is less important than the effect of the message. And the reason I spend a little bit of time there is because, doesn't this sound familiar? A little bit? The media being involved in swaying public opinion, truth not being all that important.
It's nothing.
It's long wait as we. And that's why I spend just a minute to discuss that, because certainly before I read about this time period, I sort of had it in my head that, you know, back then, it, you know, things were less corrupt and things were a lot cleaner, things were a lot more civil. But as we'll see, particularly as Washington leaves office, the elections of 1796 and 1800 were probably among, if not some of the worst and dirtiest elections the country has seen. So it's really, it's what we see today is nothing new. And if you ever hear anyone claim or make the argument that, oh, if we could just go back to the way it was, feel free to correct them, because it was never that clean.
Politics has been kind of a dirty word, clear back to Roman times. You see the quotes clear back then about politics and politicians.
So, moving on to the election of 1796, this is significant because it's the first contested election. Up until that point, it was a foregone conclusion, one, that George Washington was going to be the first president, and that two, no one was, you know, there, it was going to be unanimous. So, the first two elections, Washington served for two terms as president. So up until that point, there was no real need for any contest or campaigning. But when he retires, well, we need to find a successor. And the other thing that happens is, with Washington retiring, up until this point, Washington, his reputation in his credentials, in what he did for helping to secure American independence, sort of left him or put him in a position of being untouchable. So Jefferson and the Republicans, while they certainly opposed a lot of the Federalist concepts and different things in the Washington administration. They always did it in sort of a reserved and being very careful to steer clear of George Washington. So there's a lot of more whispering, more private communication. Now that Washington's out of the way, now there's no one that has that same reputation. Now it's fair game, and that's essentially sort of what opens up and creates a situation where you know, these elections really do become quite dirty. Adams represents the Federalists, and Jefferson represents the Republicans. And here is where the rift really begins to form in a very meaningful way. There's a lot of things said, and it basically comes down to just their ideologies are different. And that has, in the new government, come to the forefront, and they've now become more more rivals than friends, and that's unfortunate. And it's interesting because during this time there isn't any campaigning. You're not allowed to campaign for office, because by campaigning you are basically showing that you're not worthy of the office. So it creates an interesting situation in those early elections where you need to campaign without making it look like you're campaigning, which Jefferson was quite good at, Adams less so. But in any event, it was a very close election. Adams does win, and up until, I believe it was the 12th Amendment, where the president and vice president were on one ticket and you elected both, it was the person that had the second most votes became vice president. So, as happened in this situation, the opposition was elected along with Adams, which, in one sense, could have created an opportunity, and Adams attempted to make use of it, which we'll get into in a minute. But there was an inherent problem or difficulty, no matter who got elected, that they were going to face when replacing Washington or succeeding Washington. And that was, no one was going to be able to replace him. And Jefferson, he's writing to Madison, he sums it up nicely. The president, meaning Washington, is fortunate to get off just as the bubble is bursting, leaving others to hold the bag. Yet as his departure will mark the moment when the difficulties begin to work, you will see that they will be ascribed to the new administration. As a very astute remark on Jefferson's part, recognizing that really part of what was holding the status quo together was Washington and his reputation. Now that Washington's gone, that's opening up the avenue for direct opposition opposition to the administration, direct and open. And Jefferson recognizes that. Adams, for his part, certainly recognizes the challenges that are in front of him, knowing that it's obviously a critical juncture, and there's a lot, and I haven't gone into a lot of details in terms of the history that's going on here, but one of the things that's going on is a quasi-war with France in. There's a lot of animosity. There's a lot of push for going to war with France, and Adams realizes that we need to avoid that at all costs. We can't afford to get entangled in the war. And he looks at it that if we can get Jefferson, or if Jefferson and I, who we've had our disagreements, we've been on the different sides, but if we can come together like we did back in 76, we can make the best of this. And so he reaches out to Jefferson to make him an important part of the administration. Part of the motivation there, I think, is because Adams felt, you know, as his quotes show, he felt like he was, I wouldn't say being wasted, but wasn't offered a position to give counsel as often as he would like in the Washington administration, so was sort of offering that up to Jefferson, but also recognizing that together they would be better than trying to navigate it on his own. And he does this sort of through different friends, and we can see that Jefferson writes, "My friends inform me that Mr. A, or meaning Mr. Adams, speaks of me with great friendship and with satisfaction in the prospect of administering the government in concurrence with me." And Adams really did make an effort to meet with him. He actually wanted to send a commission to France to negotiate, and wanted, if he had his choice, wanted Jefferson to lead it, but thought it would be inappropriate to have the vice president do it. So he was actually approached Jefferson to inquire if Madison would be willing to do that, which was a huge risk in one sense for Adams as a Federalist. Of course, he didn't consider himself a Federalist. But when he broached this idea with his Federalist cabinet, they thought he was being quite irresponsible. And Madison, for his part, refused, didn't want to lend his support to an administration that he felt it was his duty to oppose. So, essentially, what happens? Jefferson, for his part, initially is actually receptive to this idea, this idea of and renewing that friendship and working and coordinating and working together with Adams. And he writes this letter shortly after Adams wins the election. And it's a bit lengthy, but this would have been to Adams. "No one then will congratulate you with purer disinterestedness than myself. I devoutly wish you may be able to shun for us this war by which our agriculture, commerce, and credit will be destroyed. If you are, the glory will be all your own, and that your administration may be filled with glory and happiness to yourself, an advantage to us is the sincere wish of one who, though in the course of our voyage through life, various little incidents have happened or been contrived to separate us, retains still for you the solid esteem of the moments when we were working for our independence and sentiments of respect and affectionate attachment." Unfortunately, that letter never got sent to Adams. Jefferson sent it to Madison to advise him on whether he thought it was appropriate. Madison told him no, it was not. And he said, "If you're interested in showing your esteem and for John Adams and kind of making amends or wishing them well, you can do that through other avenues. These statements in here are setting yourself up for a situation that if they either aren't successful or the administration is successful, that doesn't bode well for us as the opposition party. So Madison convinces Jefferson to forego being heavily involved in the administration and to play the role of party politics, and it's our job to work against and essentially criticize this Federalist administration, which is unfortunate. Right here, it's Jefferson allows the party to trump the friendship, and that ultimately is really what sort of just as potentially they could come back together, that really effectively severs or does uncorrectable damage to the friendship at that point. And as could be predicted, Adams has a difficult, I almost said pregnancy, presidency. That would have woken you up. And it wasn't difficult to predict. And I wonder if Jefferson, you know, hadn't have sent that letter to Madison for him to review, and hadn't been convinced to step back from the administration, if history may have been different for Adams and his presidency. Obviously, it's conjecture at this point. But Adams' main success was he did avoid the war with France, which was, it sounds sort of simple. you just don't go to war. But it required quite a bit of navigation because, and as I put here, he ends up in political no man's land because he's getting opposed because he's aligned with the Federalists. He's getting opposed by the Republicans, both even within his administration, Jefferson being the culprit there, who is even, he's writing to the minister in France, James Monroe, telling him to tell the French, don't bother dealing with this, just delay, you don't even need to talk to him. He's only there for a short period of time, and then he'll be replaced with someone who's going to, like myself, who's going to be more apt to listen to you. So he's getting opposed that way, getting worked against that way. He's also opposed by Hamilton, who's the Federalist. One of the mistakes Adams makes is he, rather than hiring or appointing his own cabinet, he inherits Washington's cabinet, which, you know, there was no precedent for how that was supposed to be handled. That's how he chose to handle it. He didn't know if he had the right to fire the different secretaries. And unfortunately, they were all, they weren't loyal to Adams. They were loyal to Hamilton. And so he ends up, by not playing party politics to his credit, that sets him up to a point where he's getting fire from both sides, which didn't help him in his presidency. And ultimately, it's really only in hindsight does he get the credit he probably deserves for avoiding the war with France. He had the Federalists pushing for it within his own administration. He had, following the XYZ affair, even those who were pro France, the XYZ affair was the French associates were looking for a bribe from the Americans, 50,000 pounds, before they would treat with them. And Adams does his best to keep that, to not go public, because he knows if there is, that does go public, there's going to be an outcry for war. So he navigates that in a very careful way. But of course, not doing something is a difficult thing to receive credit for at the time. And as it turns out, the election of 1800 is what some historians call one of the dirtiest elections, if not the dirtiest, in American history. There's a lot of tabloid-like press. Adams is labeled a monarchist. Anyone think of a reason why that label might stick in particular to Mr. Adams in a way that it wouldn't stick to many of the other founders and many of the first presidents of the United States? Well,
he was a lawyer and he believed in the kind of law that Britain had.
Mm-hmm.
And also he was an ambassador to Britain.
Yep. That was the first thing people jumped on was, you spent all this time in Great Britain. You love all things English. He was a big supporter of sort of loftier titles for the president. So those all kind of fit into it. But one of the things that Adams had that none of the other founding and first presidents had, he had a son. So there was all kinds of accusations that came out of that Adams is interested in the presidency and he's just going to set it up so that his son can come in and take over. So there's all sorts of that, which of course none of that was furthest from the truth. John Quincy does get elected eventually, but certainly not through any machinations on John Adams' part. What really wounds Adams the most during this election, because there's bad things being said on both sides, against Adams, against Jefferson, most of it untrue. But for Adams, the unforgivable part is that Jefferson himself is sanctioning a lot of this smearing of Adams. And despite his explicit denials, there's proof and evidence that he was not only sanctioning it, but he was providing the financial support for it and directing it in some instances. There's no such evidence for Adams participating in that. And that's something that's what really takes Adams a long time to sort of to get over that that breach and be able to trust and respect Jefferson once again. In the end, Jefferson wins the election and Aaron Burr becomes the vice president. I've already run over and I apologize for keeping you. Adams retires to Quincy where he begins to lick his wounds. And we'll pick up there next time and work and see how, even after all of this, there is that reconciliation towards the latter part of their lives. Any closing comments or questions? Yes.
Isn't it true that, like what he said, what you were saying about the bubble that was going to burst, Washington's administration actually set the groundwork for this kind of turmoil that was going to burst right after he left office, right?
There was certainly a lot of factors that were going into that. I don't know that it was necessarily Washington's fault. One thing that's clear in my reading it is that there was there was still a lot of respect for the administration because Washington was a part of it. Once he left, that opened the door for more direct and open criticism and that sort of thing, which Adams faced. Do you mind closing us in prayer?
Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for our rich heritage you've given to us as Americans, and in particular the lessons we've learned in terms of our own friendships and loyalties. And pray now, sir, to forgive us. Be with each one as we bless our coffee time, and particularly this particular worship time, to there'll be great joy in Jesus' name.
Amen.